From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Syria is more than bad enough on its own terms now. The protest-turned-civil war that has engulfed a nation. But what if it goes bigger, pulls in the whole region, engulfs the Middle East? In striking ways, it is already happening. Are we moving toward multi-state sectarian war? This hour on Point, Syria and the risk of regional war in the Middle East. You can join us on air or online. How wide could this go? Has it gone already? Where does this conflict end? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Already we're hearing testimony from high-placed people, including the U.S. military, saying this thing is moving. Here was May 27th. Former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, called the civil war in Syria a regional war, looking at the increased involvement of Hezbollah fighters from Lebanon and Iran and beyond.
It ties Iran to the conflict, which has been true for some time now. Hezbollah putting its oomph behind the regime. I think it is a regional war. There's, of course, stories about Iraqi fighters going there to fight as well. And so it's Iran, Iraq's involved, maybe not Iraq officially, but Iraq unofficially, perhaps. It is a regional conflict already, I think.
It's a regional conflict already. In a moment, we'll be joined by former U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker and Syria expert Andrew Tabler. But first, from London, we're joined by Rula Khalaf, Middle East editor for the Financial Times. Rula, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
This has just gone from bad to worse. But in the last week, we're hearing more and more people saying this is moving maybe beyond proxy war. Lots of people have had a hand in here. It's spilling out. It's showing the real risk of turning into something regional. What are the signs of that that people are pointing to and worried about, Rula?
I think that from the beginning of the militarized phase of this conflict, it has been something of a, it's turned into something of a proxy war because everybody has been involved on the side of the regime. Obviously, Iran has been a very big supporter, and on the side of the rebels, the Saudis and the Qataris mainly, but other Arab Sunni Arab states have also come in. What has changed, and I think has raised a lot of concern more recently in the last few weeks, is that Hezbollah, the Shia militant group in Lebanon, which has been involved to a certain extent for a while, has now made its involvement much bigger, much more public. Obviously, there is a spillover effect that we've also seen, whether it's in bombs exploding in Turkey, floods of refugees in Jordan and Lebanon, and the whole Lebanese political system divided over how you handle Syria. I think Hezbollah's involvement has now raised the question of whether this war can actually then be transferred onto Lebanese soil. That is not what either Hezbollah or any of its Sunni opponents in Lebanon wants. I think that they all think that we can keep, you know, we'll all fight each other in Syria, we'll keep it contained in Syria. But these things are not really that controllable at the end of the day. And if you start having attacks, for instance, against Hezbollah targets in Lebanon and then, you know, retaliation, even if the political leaders don't want it, that doesn't mean that it can be stopped. And I think that is essentially what is now raising even more concern because everything's become a lot more overt.
We're also hearing on NPR this morning about backwash into Iraq. You've got, of course, I've had for a long time, heavy Sunni-Shiite tension in Iraq. You've got the Iraqis coming into Syria to fight now as well, Sunni by and large, against the regime there. And we're reading that the violence is kind of filtering back into Iraq itself and heading us back toward a more violent time there.
Yes, I think that is being seen now as another sign, but it's very important to deconstruct also what's going on. There is an issue in Iraq itself between a Shia government mm-hmm. that has essentially marginalized the Sunni minority and not brought them into in any inclusive way into the political system.
Right.
The Sunni areas of Iraq have essentially been now in rebellion with protests going on for months. it's that frustration that is spilling over into violence. In addition to that, Syria essentially makes it worse. When you have one country in the heart of the region that's essentially exploding, in which the conflict for control of the state is taking on much more sectarian tones, then it's likely to make other similar conflicts worse. You have some radical Sunni have joined the rebellion in Syria, for instance, on the side of Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you also have some small Shia groups who've been sending fighters to Syria. What Syria is doing is it's exacerbating all the sectarian tensions that are already present elsewhere, and making domestic crisis much more difficult to handle.
What about those sectarian tensions turning into conflict that goes regional? I mean, I've got a little tape here, Rula. This was NPR's Kelly McEvers in Lebanon on Monday, and she was talking with the father of two Hezbollah fighters already killed in Syria. And this father saying, you know, sectarian war is coming. Total war, he said, between Sunnis and Shiites across the region is coming. Here he is.
Libya, Saudi, Turkey, he says, we are ready to fight. It's already started, he says. Only God can stop it now.
Rula Khalaf, you're watching from London. Is that just a father in his grief, or is that a real concern that this Shia-Sunni historic tension could break into open conflict across the region?
I think what this reflects is what has been used to mobilize, the arguments that have been used to mobilize the Shia population in Lebanon and to justify intervention by Hezbollah on the part of the Shia regime. The narrative that you hear is that all of the opposition in Syria are Sunni extremists and that they are supported by Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and that they're coming to get, they are essentially waging a war all across the region against the Shia. That is not really true, but that is a narrative that is quite attractive if you're being asked to go and fight in Syria.
Well, you say it's not true, but we're told increasingly that the most effective fighting groups in Syria have been allied with fundamentalist Sunni interests.
Yes, well, I mean, there are a lot of different groups that are fighting in Syria. Many of them are Islamists. What I'm saying is that the way that Hezbollah has portrayed what's going on in Syria is that there are only very extremist Sunni who are fighting, and that once they finish fighting in Syria, they will then come and fight Hezbollah in Lebanon. And I think that is being exploited. This is the excuse that is being used to tell the Shia fighters in Lebanon, you must go and make sure that the fight stops in Syria so that it doesn't come our way.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and the Russians are still talking about a meeting at some point not too long from now to try and negotiate something here. Are there hopes that that could be effective, or does that look like a pipe dream?
I don't think that this is the time when you can bring the regime and the opposition together to agree a plan that is essentially a political transition, that essentially severely reduces, in fact, puts Bashar al-Assad or forces him to step aside. You know, the regime in Syria, the Bashar al-Assad regime today, is doing much better on the battlefield. So the idea that they are somehow going to come and give up power, I think, is a pipe dream.
Rula Khalaf with the Financial Times joining us today from London, Middle East editor there. It's always great to talk with you, Rula. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, we'll talk with Ryan Crocker, former U.S. ambassador to Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Kuwait, Afghanistan, and more. With us right now from Washington, Andrew Tabler, senior fellow at the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, focuses on Syria. Andrew Tabler, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
You've got a big piece coming out saying in Foreign Affairs, headlined, Syria's collapse. If Syria collapses, Do things keep right on collapsing? People are talking about boundaries drawn in the colonial era going away, neighbors being drawn in, the possibility of the entire region getting engulfed. We talked with former U.S. Ambassador to Syria, Ted Khatouf. He said at this point, 25% to 40% chance of a regional Middle East conflagration. That's less than half, but much larger than comforting.
Yeah, I think, and I've made a number of trips to Syrian border regions over the last year. You can see a marked deterioration in terms of the, what's going on inside of Syria and the breakdown of Syria into three Syrias, that controlled by the regime, that controlled by the Sunni Arab rebels, and those controlled by the Kurds. But the most important thing, as you bring it up, is that the conflict is already spilling over its borders. Hezbollah operating on behalf of the regime over the increasingly meaningless Lebanese frontier, and the spill out of refugees into countries, most notably Jordan, which just do not have a lot of resources to take care of these refugees. It is an increasingly dangerous situation, and it is a what I call a. It's not just that Syria is collapsing. I think it's just melting down. It's like a Chernobyling of the country itself, with very deep implications for the borders in the Middle East and in the regional security architecture around key U.S. allies, including Israel.
Do you see the risk of this moving from proxy war? We know Iran's already in there. People have their interests there. Turning from that into something more openly regional, interstate, multi-state, beyond Syria.
I do. I think that we're moving in that direction, and I think it's the only question is how do we stop it?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the conflict in Syria, pulling in its neighbors and spreading the risks and scenarios that this could even go to some kind of regional war. Lots of people thinking and talking about this. John McCain famously last week in Syria saying we've already got a regional civil war here. This was from CBS's This Morning after that visit, saying that time's running out to avoid it. Here's McCain.
It's shameful what's going on, and it's destabilizing all these other countries in the region. Jordan cannot last under this present scenario. As we're seeing, fighting has started in Lebanon, and this thing could spread and engulf the entire Middle East in a civil war.
The entire Middle East in a civil war. We're looking at that risk here today. Andrew Tabler is with us. He's senior fellow in the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, author of In the Lion's Den. His forthcoming article in Foreign Affairs is Syria's Collapse and How Washington Can Stop It. Well, we'll test that notion. With us as well right now from New Haven, Connecticut, is one of the most prominent American diplomats in the history of this region, Ryan Crocker. He served as U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. He is currently a senior fellow at Yale's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs, on leave from Texas A&M, where he serves as dean of the Bush School of Government and Public Service. Ambassador Ryan Crocker, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
How do you assess the danger of this bloody and terrible already civil war in Syria, pulling in more of the region, becoming a real regional conflict?
Well, I think Rula and Andrew made some very good points. This is a sectarian conflict. It is denominated in Sunni versus Shia. So I think in any country where you have those mixed populations, there is the potential for a real meltdown. We are already seeing it in Iraq. Rula made the very good point that sectarian tension there is indigenous. It didn't come from Syria, but the Syrian situation has exacerbated as the al-Qaeda elements in both countries come together to try and reignite the sectarian conflict that was so brutal in 06, 07. And we're seeing, again, the emerging of, or the re-emerging of radical Shia militia as a counter to it. And it's already in Lebanon. I was there a couple of weeks ago. I talked to senior officials. They gloomily predicted that Lebanon would be drawn in, and we've seen it already start in northeastern Lebanon, in the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli, in Beirut itself, and it's likely to get worse. But it is not likely, I think, to be a conflagration that sets fire to the whole Middle East. It is a Sunni-Shia sectarian conflict. It's not about religion, it's about power. It is a proxy war. As Rula noted, Iran's in it, including with their proxy Hezbollah, and the Saudis and the Qataris are in it to counter Iran. You know, how far could it go? You know, there could be more trouble in Bahrain that has seen a Sunni-Shia clash in the past. The Saudis are deeply worried about what could happen in their predominantly Shia eastern province, which sits on their oil fields. Yemen has a mixed Sunni-Shia population, but I think there the contest for power is denominated more in tribal terms than sectarian. Beyond that, you know, you don't see that divide in Arab North Africa or elsewhere in the Arabian Peninsula. But it's bad enough, and there is an urgent need for active U.S. diplomacy right now, starting in Iraq. You know, we can make a difference. I know from my own experience that what the Iraqis will not give to each other, they will give to us as a impartial mediator. Andrew's right about Jordan. We need to do everything we can to shore them up. We're doing a lot to support refugees. We need to do more. We need to do the same in Lebanon. So, you know, there is a need for U.S. resources. There is a need for U.S. diplomacy. There is most definitely not a need for U.S. boots on the ground.
We'll look at that. What could the U.S. do, Ambassador Crocker, in Iraq to help contain and calm the situation in Syria? You said there's room for U.S. diplomacy in Iraq right next door. What?
It's simply being present at a senior level. We've got a great ambassador, some great people out of state, but this takes the Secretary of State. It took the Secretary of State during my time there at moments of extreme ethnic and sectarian tension. You know, I'd like to think I was the greatest ambassador on earth, but there are times you need bigger guns, and this is one of those times. It requires a John Kerry, I think, to, you know, go in, sit down with the Shia, sit down with the Sunnis, sit down with the Kurds, listen to them, deliver a message of moderation, and try to start to put together the kinds of arrangements we had when I left in early 2009. You know, none of these groups want to see the country blow up again, but it's zero-sum thinking. These are new fledgling democracies. They compromise means concession, means defeat, but they will give things to us as mediators that they won't give to each other, and we need to be playing that role right now.
Ambassador Crocker, stand by there. Andrew Taylor, you're listening in Washington, and I'm so glad to have you here as well. You know, you look at everything that seems to be, we've got this new unrest in Turkey now. We've got active fighting that's happened in Lebanon already around Syria. As you say, the strain on Jordan, not just the refugees, but the sort of risk of destabilization there. Israel looking on, it must be on such tenterhooks right now. And then we get to the big sort of proxy players here. We heard Robert Malley, the International Crisis Group, talking with Terry Gross yesterday, and just at the end of their conversation, you know, he's saying this has become not just a war within Syria, it's become a regional sectarian civil war. What was a war in Syria with regional spillover has now become a regional war with a Syrian focus. What keeps this proxy war, if that's what it is in Syria, with so many big powers having a hand in here, never mind Russia and the U.S., Iran, as Ambassador Crocker says, and Saudi Arabia, what keeps it at the proxy level? What would unleash it from the proxy level, from the borders of Syria, Andrew?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think Ambassador Crocker, you know, lays this out very well. You know, we're not looking here at, I don't think that what we're going to see out of Syria is like Armageddon, you know, where you suddenly have one dramatic battle that's, you know, that sort of decisively changes everything. I think it's the accumulation of small things. And I think here what we're looking at is a proxy war inside of Syria is already going on. And you can see it by who's backing the different groups, with Hezbollah and Iran backing the regime, with the Sunni Arab powers, Qatar and Saudi Arabia backing the Sunni Arab powers, and then the Kurds, you know, being assisted by other Kurds. The thing is that, you know, going forward, it's, does this stay within Syria or does it spill outside and destabilize neighboring countries? And there, Ambassador Crocker is right. You know, if you look at a country like Lebanon, I recently also was in Lebanon and went to the North Bakaa region and watched Hezbollah fighters assisting in the regime's assault of the city of Qusair, which they took over today from the rebels, a vital area. To watch Hezbollah rocket fire from Lebanon into Syria against other Arabs was nothing short of amazing. You know, for someone who, like, I spent about 14 years in the region, to watch that instead of rockets going southward towards Israel and the common, mm-hmm. you know, the frequent wars, you know, it's another sign combined with what's going on in Jordan and Turkey that the Syria crisis is less and less containable. It might not end up in one giant battle that is decisive, but I think that this Syria-centered crisis is likely, as Robert Malley was saying, to become this sectarian war, and it will just happen over time. The question is, how much does that degrade the security architecture in the Middle East, particularly around Syria? And I think the biggest issue is, you know, the countries immediately affected by Syria, and, you know, we're looking at, you know, unlike Lebanon and its civil war, Syria is not the row house on the end of the block. It's in the middle of the block. Yep. You know, and so what happens there in the middle of the block affects Lebanon, it affects Turkey, it affects Iraq, it affects Jordan, and it affects Israel. It's very hard to see how everything that's going on in that country does not, in the end, affect the politics on the other side of the border, and with it potentially the drawing of those borders, perhaps in the very distant future. That's, you know, that's really just speculation at this point. But we're looking at a crisis here that will probably last, I would say, you know, at least 5 years, if not longer, in one way, shape, or form, and has the potential to transform the borders around Syria.
Ryan Crocker, you've got people now talking about a half a century or more, maybe, of post-colonial borders and general order maybe being up for grabs. Do you see that? Do you see that borders could end up changed on the other side of this? Your fellow former U.S. Ambassador to Syria, Ted Katouf, saying to us, you know, this could go on 3-5 years, a decade, Turkey, Jordan destabilized, no guarantee that the borders will hold, he said to us. Can you see, is the map being redrawn here? The old strategic security architecture that Andrew talks about, is it going away?
It's, of course, a fascinating question. I think it's premature to panic. These borders have, artificial as they may be, they have held through decades of challenge, and I think they're more likely to hold now than not. The unrest in Turkey is, in my view, completely unrelated to what's going on in Syria. It's a reaction against the policies of the Erdogan government, and it is, you know, Turkish in its nature, and it will be resolved in Turkish terms. Likely spillover and outcomes, we've talked about, and I think we've all been in agreement on the countries that can be affected. We need to do everything we can to support the refugee populations in particularly the small countries, Lebanon and Jordan. We've done a lot. We've got to keep an eye on it. These countries can easily be stabilized, and they have been, by refugee inflows in the past from the Palestinians. We need to be sure that we're doing everything we can through the UN to see that it doesn't happen again. But we also need to think about likely outcomes in Syria. And I think there are two. Either you get Somalia by the Mediterranean, in which the lines roughly stabilize around where they are, with the rebels in the north, the Assad regime controlling the rest of the country, or you're going to see a process, meter by bloody meter, in which the Assad regime retakes control of the country. Frankly, I think the latter is the most likely. This is not part of the Arab Spring. The Assad regime has been ready for this fight since 1982, when they laid siege to Hama to eliminate the Muslim Brothers. They did that, maybe 150 of them.
Mm-hmm.
They also killed between 10 and 20,000 innocent Sunni civilians. They knew there would be a backlash someday, sometime, and they have built an architecture to deal with that. And that architecture is holding. As Andrew notes, Qusair has now fallen. An enormous...
To the central government forces again, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and that is an enormous strategic loss to the opposition, which is actually more busy fighting itself, as far as I can tell, than they are the Assad regime, with, as Rula said, the more extreme al-Qaeda-related elements coming out on top. It's going to be ugly. It's going to be prolonged. But I think at the end of the day, the Assad regime is going to take the country back.
Andrew Tabler, I wonder if Washington, despite everything we've heard from Washington, might end up welcoming that. I mean, if Ambassador Crocker's right that you've got al-Qaeda-related forces on top of the rebel effort now, and you've got this risk of a wider regional unraveling here, which is pretty mind-boggling to contemplate. I mean, Obama administration officials, the president, the secretary of state have said Assad must go, Assad will go, but maybe Assad staying once again becomes the path toward stability, however deeply bloody.
Yeah, I think that it's possible. I think what's much more likely, though, is that Assad controls part of the country. And it's something that we've been talking here for the better part of a year about, what happens. Some predicted that the Assad regime would fall. I always thought that it would probably pull back or contract. And I think that what's more probably realistic in the short term is that that Assad just holds on to part of the country and then begins to, as Ambassador Crocker said, meter by meter, try and retake the rest of the country. It's, in my opinion, and based on what I've seen, around Syria and inside of Syria, I think it'll be very difficult to do so. It's not just that they do have the military capability, and the opposition is divided to a certain extent, but the opposition has been effective in a number of other areas with relatively light weapons at fighting the regime. The real question in my mind is, if you look at some of the things, the architecture that Ambassador Crocker was talking about that they've been preparing, and I agree with him since 1982, that outcome of that massacre, which was terrible in 1982,
Hama,
in Hama, generated two things. One is Syrians stayed home for 10 years and just had a lot of babies, and it's those people. Syria was among the 20 fastest growing populations on the planet. Mm-hmm. In those 10 years following that massacre. It's the people that were born during that time that are now swarming the regime. The regime previously could handle that. I don't think it can any longer. Two, it's resorted to firing Scud missiles on its own population into its largest city. I don't know any central government that's ever fired Scud missiles, or that many, over 350 on its own population, and came back politically over the entire country.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the conflict in Syria, pulling in its neighbors and spreading, spilling over, looking at the risks and scenarios that this could go even to some kind of regional conflict. Proxy level, it's there already, and many see a risk of it going beyond that. With U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker, served as ambassador to Syria, to Lebanon, to Iraq, to Kuwait, to Afghanistan, to Pakistan. He's really been around. He's with us today. Andrew Tabler is here, author of In the Lion's Den, and a big new piece coming out in Foreign Affairs, the next issue, Syria's Collapse and How Washington Can Stop It, is the subtitle there. We will ask about that. Ambassador Crocker, Andrew Taylor, lots of people waiting here. Frank in Boston, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Frank.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The United States gambled and poured gasoline on this, and they were expecting Assad to fall, and he hasn't fallen. And we've had a civil war in this country back in 1861 to 65, where people were firing missiles into each other's city, killed a lot of Indians. And I don't understand why we want to have radicalized Sunnis, the same folks who attacked us on 9/11, killed our ambassador in Libya, who we disposed of in Iraq, and we've had a lot of dead soldiers over there. Why are we backing these folks?
Well, I'm not sure we are backing them. Andrew Taylor, part of the hesitancy here, I think, is that the U.S. doesn't want to end up backing radical Sunnis. It's the radical Sunnis who appear on top of the heap now among the rebels. Has that been the effect of Washington's position? That was kind of more than implicit critique of Senator John McCain out there last week.
Right.
Has this been the outcome of Washington's path?
It has. The Syrian uprising as a whole is not radical, right? I mean, there are radical elements within it, and those radical elements have grown as a result of the nationalist and local battalions and individuals not receiving assistance from the West and from the United States. So it's not like the United States is supporting extremist elements, right? In their hour of need, Syrians turn to any quarter, as people do. And so a number of those with extremist agendas stepped into that void. Now, if I thought this conflict was going to go away tomorrow, I would tend to agree with this, right? Okay, let's just wash our hands of it. But it's not, right? This is going to go on for a very long time. It's a political game that we're looking at here in Syria, and the way to affect it is through military means. And in this sense, is we have to find nationalist and more, you know, more liberal elements of the opposition, which we know about, and support them, and then play it for the long game. It's very complicated. It's not going to be easy. I do not support sending assistance to extremists or anyone among the Syrian opposition, and even most of the Salafists in the country. But I think that based on my observations there and my own research, I still think that there are factions that we can back, and we should try and work with them as this long slog unfolds in Syria.
Ambassador Crocker, the United States went into Iraq, and we all saw the ironic outcome that it ended up being very close to a longtime U.S. foe, Iran. Now, we haven't gone into Syria, and in spite of that, you've got some pretty tough al-Qaeda elements, very prominent in the Syrian opposition now. You know, are we getting the bad U.S. outcome again, this time not by going in?
I don't think we know enough about what's going on in the opposition to make a rational decision about going in or not going in. I would advocate something rather different, which is rather than boots on the ground, wingtips and pumps on the ground, meaning the Foreign Service.
Yeah.
You know, a small number of Arabic-speaking, regionally savvy, relatively junior diplomats who can operate beneath the radar to get into country. There will be risk. And yes, we all remember Benghazi.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Turks could be very helpful in this regard. I think there are areas where we could operate with reasonable security. But, you know, until we have people on the ground who know their business and can make, you know, intelligent assessments, we would be firing blind. And, you know, we saw where that got us in Iraq. I lived it. You know, let's know what we're doing before we do it. You know, that can't be done unless we have professionals, you know, on the ground, connected to the opposition, making assessments, using influence, and making recommendations back to Washington. I think we just have to do it.
That sounds like plenty dangerous duty. I want to look at what exactly they might do. But before I go there, we've got lots of people online, Ambassador, resisting the idea of getting involved here in much of any way. Here's one listener online writes, maybe the world should leave it all alone. I think the only way the Arab world will become peaceful is if they fight until they get sick of fighting. That sentiment is pretty common out there from what I'm reading right here. What about that, Ambassador? What are the stakes for the U.S. if this goes badly?
Well, you know, we are turning inward. Americans are tired of war. There's no question about it. But isolationism does not serve us well historically. You know, either we shape events or events shape us, whether it's Europe between the wars or it's the Middle East now. You know, I advocate diplomatic involvement, not military involvement. I think a relatively small number of diplomats and the application, as I said earlier, of some high-level influence at the level of the Secretary of State and maybe a few phone calls from the President can make a difference. And if we decide we're just going to let it go, well, we let it go in Afghanistan after the Soviet withdrawal. That led to a vicious Afghan civil war. It led to the rise of the Taliban, and it led to 9/11. This is not a region you want to ignore.
Andrew Tabler, I'll come to what you would do, but what about the let-it-go scenario? A lot of public sentiment is still leaning in that direction. What potential consequences do you see?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Middle East as a whole, but I think particularly Syria in particular, this isn't Vegas, right? You know, what happens there doesn't stay there. And particularly given the location of Syria, look, you have the meltdown of a country into multiple parts, and that has direct threat over the borders and so on, and potentially, and we don't know if that's going to happen or not. But look, Syria is home to the largest chemical weapons stockpile in the Middle East, right? The Assad regime is increasingly attempting to transfer strategic weapons to Hezbollah. It doesn't include chemical weapons until now. Also, there's a chance that those weapons might fall into the hands of the rebels, right? So what happens there on an individual basis could impact the United States down the road, whether it's in the region or elsewhere. I agree with Ambassador Crocker, and I argue this in my piece as well. We need to work with the opposition, and we need people with other footwear than combat boots on the ground. The question is, after Benghazi, how do you do that safely? You know, that tragically took the life of a fantastic diplomat that I knew very, very well, and I think Ambassador Crocker did as well, Chris Stevens, mm-hmm. and his very personalized, direct style of diplomacy. We need that kind of forceful, assertive approach. The question is, how do you do it safely, and how do you do it in a very chaotic situation like Syria?
And how do they make a difference? I mean, you've got Iran pumping weapons in there, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. They've got people in there as well. You got Russia all over this thing. How do a few American diplomats, relatively junior, Ambassador Crocker says, with support from above, wingtips and pumps, how do they get in and really make a difference? What can they say or offer, Andrew?
I think one of the problems is there are two things that I've learned over my time in Syria or elsewhere in the region. There's A, nothing beats being there. Personal relationships are very, very important and are key. And third, every time, and I think anybody who's ever worked in an office or anywhere, anytime you try and solve a problem via somebody that you think is your ally, in this case, Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Turkey, your message gets distorted. People don't understand you. And this is one of those times when the light footprint or leading from behind or whatever you want to call it doesn't work. You need to be able to directly communicate with these folks. We are already contacting them via Skype and via border regions, and very capable U.S. diplomats that Ambassador Crocker is talking about are already doing that. But the problem is so much of what's going on in Syria goes on deeply inside, and they need to understand the American position, and we need to be able to reach out to them, but to do it in a safe way that avoids what happened in Benghazi.
We've got David calling. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Excellent discussion today, obviously very important. My question is fairly simple, and I guess it echoes some elements of what's already been said, but I'll say it again. You have basically an al-Qaeda-led rebel, or at least heavily infiltrated by al-Qaeda, armed rebel group fighting the Syrian regime, which is essentially a proxy for Hezbollah. Hezbollah has has the blood of 264 Marines on its hands. Al-Qaeda and its fellow travelers,
yeah.
You know, have the blood of 9/11 and everything else on their hands. So, I mean, it's a callous statement, but in a sense, it echoes it. What's the downside? The two of them are killing each other. And if we stand by, obviously we lose friends in the region and there's tremendous civilian toll. I understand that. But getting involved on the ground, even as civilians, puts us in the risk of kidnapping, of collateral damage to our own people on the ground. Can we afford it?
And Ambassador Crocker, what do you say?
Yes, we can. Foreign service officers raise their right hands and swear the same oath that our brothers and sisters in uniform do, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And that does not mean just in the cafes of Paris and the bistros of Brussels. It means in the hard places. And no place is harder, more challenging, or more critical than Syria, just as Andrew said. I think we can get a small number of people in there. They will be at risk. One sad blowback from Benghazi is a sentiment that we can never afford to lose a diplomat. Well, we diplomats differ. We will go into harm's way, and, some get killed doing it. It is sad, but when you look at the number of service members who have died fighting for our country's security, it's a risk worth taking. And Andrew's dead right. You can't do this by remote. You've got to be on the ground, and the stakes are high. This is not simply about al-Qaeda killing Hezbollah and vice versa. That would be great if it was. But this is about a war that is at the heart of the Middle East, and Andrew said it very well. This is not, the ramshackle house at the end of the street. This is in the middle of the block.
If I may, Andrew Tabler, let's say we don't. Or let's say we do go in, as you suggest, and Ambassador Crocker goes in. We try, and we're not successful. Where does this go? What does Israel ultimately do here? What do the players who are proxy, sort of, at this point, do if it goes on? I mean, you write, you say Syria's paroxysms, if allowed to drag on, could potentially spread far and wide, even change the map of the region. If we don't go in, or if we do go in and fail, what unfolds here, Andrew?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I ultimately think that we can shape the outcome here, and we can try and pursue U.S. interests much more in a much more assertive way. That Ambassador Crocker has discussed this, and I think it's a really important. But in the end, we're not going to be able to completely extinguish this. We can contain it. We can try and deal with it. We can try and stop it together with other allies. But along the way, some things are going to work. Some things are not going to work. We're going to need to use all the knobs and the dials on the dashboard, right, to be able to turn some things off and turn other things on and be able to understand how do we get Assad to step aside, as we've outlined, right, lead to a really good transition that stabilizes the country and bring about a peaceful, democratic, and prosperous post-Assad Syria, okay, in the long term. And we're just going to have to learn through doing, and we're going to have to do it with the Syrian people, okay, on the ground in Syria, and not without them at the UN Security Council alone.
I mean, right? I think people are pretty skeptical about that. After the experience of Iraq, learn by doing, very costly, and then we're gone and it's not solved.
That's correct. And I think this is actually very instructive. Now, the difference, of course, is we don't have boots on the ground. The Syrian opposition doesn't want our boots on the ground. We don't want to put boots on the ground. But we have a lot of other instruments that we can use, much more assertive diplomacy. We could use pinpointed strikes. We can use indirect intervention through support for the opposition. And we can use diplomacy at the UN eventually to try and shape this, right? And so we're going to have to turn a lot of things on and off. But look, whether we do anything or not, this conflict is going to continue. I'm saying the trajectories that we see, and those of us that focus on it, and those in the government also, and I think you've heard former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Leon Panetta, mm-hmm. the things we see indicate that the conflict there will eat down into a lot of other things that affect our interests, right? So just because we didn't break it, doesn't mean we don't end up buying into the solution. The problem is if you do it way too late, it's often very messy and at 10 times the price. We can't afford that. We shouldn't do that. More assertive measures now are in order. The question is what to do, when, and under what circumstances.
Ryan Crocker, what do you think of the odds that we could leverage Assad out of there now that things seem to be potentially going his way? What would you do or say to make that happen?
Well, again, it's hard to do or say anything rational without knowing more than we do. And as I said, and Andrew said, you only know that if you're on the ground. It's going to be very hard, I think, to come up with a formula that has him leave power. And if he does, it isn't going to be better. You know, the next in line is his younger brother Maher, who is, you know, a brutal, effective, but brutal military commander. The Assad regime is not going to go away unless it is forced out. And I don't see the constellation of forces present to do that. But that's a supposition. I don't know. We don't know. And we're not going to know unless we use the Foreign Service for what it's supposed to be used for, to protect and support American interests where it counts most.
Well, I have to say, at this point, the boundaries look wide open to me. Ryan Crocker, former U.S. ambassador in Syria and much beyond. Andrew Tabler, author of In the Lion's Den. Thanks to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.